Hi. Can you hear me all right? Okay, if my voice drops, you'll let me know. So pretty nice. We're here. We made it. And it's nice to see everybody. It really is. And I especially want to thank everybody who did all the work to make this possible. As the years go on, I don't know how Kate and Michael do this. I don't understand how they manage to do it. It's so much effort. And then I know they're not doing it by themselves. I know that many of you are helping. And it just, as time goes on, I'm more impressed with how much work it is and how amazing it is, really, that we can pull this off. There's so many details, right? From the cooking to the bells in the zendo, to the getting the service right, to the doans, the dokusan, the whole thing. I mean, it's really, I'm exhausted just thinking about what you've done already, just getting here. And to think that in our, you know, we can do this in our time and place, that we can somehow manage to recreate this ancient way of practice, it's amazing. It really is, and I'm very grateful to all of you who, I know many of you, I don't know who exactly, but I have an idea. Many of you put in a lot of work, and I appreciate it. So here we are, and it is so rare and precious in our lives to find the time to do this. And not only the time, but the motivation, the mind, the spirit. Did you ever think, why? You know, why? Why go to all this trouble? Do you know why you're doing this? Maybe you do. Maybe you haven't even thought about it, or maybe you really have no idea whatsoever why you're doing this. And if not, I hope we can find out together why we're doing this this week. And if you think you know why you're doing it, probably you'll find out by the end of this week that there's a different reason that you haven't thought of why you're doing it. So I hope that we will take the opportunity to make a big effort and to be serious so that we can possibly go beyond what is pleasant, acceptable, understandable, and comfortable and find something that we never found before. So this year, I've been thinking about the kleshas, the defilements, which means the various ways that we get caught and hooked by our own viewpoints and feelings. We get spun around, you know, by our own minds. And this is a basic and fundamental teaching in Buddhism. Raga, dvesha, moha. Attachment, aversion, confusion. And these are forces in the body. They're in the mind and the heart, but they're in the body. They're life forces, right? They're the force that makes us live and want to live another day. But they're also the very same forces that produce aggression and suffering. So this is the tragedy, right? Life itself presses on us. And then that pressure, unwisely met, creates pain. And this is what we do. So we all know passion can be good. It can be for the good. It can be for life, for awakening, for blessings, for sharing. But the same passion can also be powerfully destructive. How do you know the difference? Only wisdom knows. Deep wisdom. Wisdom in the body, wisdom in the breath, wisdom in the heart. A kind of wisdom that you don't find by studying in books or by wishing for it or believing in it. You find it, or maybe it finds you, through the serious effort of embodied practice over time. You find it by making a strong effort. And that's why we're here this week. One of my teachers, Bernie Glassman, would often begin Dharma talks. He would say, "Hi, my name is Bernie, and I'm addicted to ego." And I think that's about right. I think we could all say this. We are all literally addicted to our preferences, our views, our sense of self, our need to protect ourselves. We're literally addicted to this. And like all addicts, we enjoy our addiction, but only up to a point. It makes sense, it works, but only up to a point. And this is the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. The big sufferings in life are hard to bear because we're so unprepared for them. Addicted to our self-preference, our self-habit, which doesn't even seem like a preference or a habit. I mean, it's so basic to us. It is us, not something other than us. That's how addicted to it we are. It's the very air we breathe. But with that addiction, little by little, without knowing we're doing it, we're making life into a prison. And we need to escape. We need to break the chains that bind us. We need to see who we really are. And this is where a compassion comes into it. Compassion isn't just being nice and kind because we feel good about that. And it's nicer to be nice than it is to be unpleasant and mean. It's much more difficult. You got to really appreciate unpleasant, mean people. They have a hard road to hoe, you know. It's tough. Much easier to be nice. But this isn't what compassion is about, really. Compassion is fiercely, accurately, and courageously seeing who we are and who others are. Breaking through our comfortable fictions, which in the end are actually not that comfortable. If they were comfortable, we would all agree, well, let's stay with them. You know, good, because comfort is good. Comfort is nice. The trouble is that what's comfortable in our view in the end is not comfortable. Our comfortable way of looking at our lives is ending us up frightened, bruised, and lonely people. And that just doesn't work for us. We really have to do what we can. We really have to do the best we can to finally get over ourselves, see through ourselves. So that's the work we have to do this week. So I'm hoping that we will all practice this week with maximum devotion. Sesshin is actually really enjoyable. It's not meant to be, you know, a grim, unhappy slog of a week. It's actually quite enjoyable. Because paying attention to your life every moment, having the luxury of really being with every moment of your life, this is the greatest pleasure. Coming back over and over and over again to your body, to your breathing, to presence, to being here as it really is, this is a pleasure. When you're on your seat, and when you're not on your seat, keeping the silence fiercely, being radically local to your experience, not talking, not making eye contact, whatever you think it might be necessary to discuss, If you think again, you realize actually it's not necessary. Probably if you forget about it and just remember that you are here, this is it. And there's nothing that matters more than being alive in this moment, then you'll probably forget about whatever it is that you thought you needed to communicate. Because life takes care of things if you leave things alone. I know that sounds hard to believe, but it's true. So support and enjoy each and every person by giving yourself and each of them the largest possible space for discovery. Your paying attention to your practice is the biggest gift that you can give to everyone else in the session. We all have personas. And that's a good thing. We need them. We've spent our entire lives with others constructing these personas. But if that's all we were, these personas, we would be in deep trouble. We've got to be more than our personas, because that's what saves us from suffering. Knowing that we ourselves and everyone else, equally and exactly in the same way, are more than our personas. Through paying very close attention to body, breathing, and consciousness itself, awareness itself, to standing, to walking, to sitting, to lying down, to moving forward and moving backward, to lifting, placing, chewing, swallowing, peeing, and everything, we can find something in ourselves more intimate than, stronger than our personas. Because our personas cannot save us. Only Buddha can save us. In other words, the largeness of our own lives. And we can't see this largeness conceptually by thinking about it or believing in it. It's absolutely necessary that we quiet our minds and hearts enough so that we can see who we really are. And this is the profound point of Zazen. This is the essential point of our practice. And this is why we're here. We just can't do this work in the same way in everyday practice. We need session. So, however many periods of Zazen there are in this session, I don't know if anybody's counted them, but however many there are, sit down at each one as if it were the first, very, very carefully. Set your posture carefully. Pay attention especially to your mudra. Notice how your thumb tips are just touching. Keizan Zenji gives the instruction, put your mind in the palms of your hand. This is a really good Zazen instruction. Don't keep your mind up here in your brain. Put it in the palms of your hand and take care of it really carefully in your hands. Feeling how the palms are gently curved and the thumb tips just touching. And when you sit up straight, you can feel the mudra slightly lifting and turning toward your belly. So there's a lightness in your hands, a lightness in your heart, and a lightness throughout your body, as if your body were not here on the earth, but sort of floating, soaring in the sky. Because this is not you. This is not your body. When you sit in Zazen in this way, you will feel that. You will feel, this is not me. This is not my body. And you can let this happen. Don't make it happen. You can't make it happen. But you can let it happen. Just apply a steady, joyful effort all these days ahead. Of course, a lot of times it's not going to feel that way, and your effort is going to lag. That's pretty normal, so don't be surprised when that happens. But when it happens, try not to rehearse the usual storylines. Oh God, how many more days to go? Why did I sign up for this? This is probably not a good idea. What am I doing here? I can't do this. Other people can do it. They can do it. Look at them. They're doing it so beautifully. I can't do this. Horrible. Don't fall back on that usual storyline. You might as well say, if you're going to think like that, you might as well say, well, forget this life. Forget this death. It's not worth it. It is worth it. Your life is really important. Your life is serious. And your life is delightful. So every time you find yourself having fallen off your steady, inspired, joyful effort and mucking around in the mud there, all you have to do is climb back on. The next breath is going to be there. Just climb back onto that next breath. And let that breath, not you, let that breath bring you back to who you really are and where you belong. In classical Buddhist language, there are many different words that we translate as mindfulness in English. Two of those words are smriti and samprajanya. And we could translate smriti usually as mindfulness, samprajanya as awareness. But actually, smriti has in it the word remember. It actually means more or less to remember. And when you think about it, mindfulness is remembering. Remembering to be mindful of something that you're trying to be mindful of. Remembering to come back when your mind wanders. Remembering to climb back on when you fell off. So this is going to happen. Your mind's going to wander. You're going to lose track of yourself. You're going to fall off a lot of times. And that's fine. It's okay to wander. That's important. Our wandering and our confusion is really important. So it's okay to wander, but it's not okay to wander if you keep on wandering and you forget to take yourself seriously as a dignified bodhisattva. If you get stuck in yourself and you're wandering around in yourself forever and ever, that's not okay. Get back on to the bodhisattva wagon. Smriti, remember. Come back to the body. Come back to the breath. Come back to where you are in this moment. Samprajanya means awareness. You remain aware of what's going on, whatever is going on. It doesn't matter what's going on. Whatever is going on, you're aware of it. Even when you have a really crappy attitude, be aware. This is a really crappy attitude. And awareness is a tremendous miracle. Consciousness is literally miraculous. There's rupa, which is form, matter, the body. We can easily understand that. The floor, the table, the sky, the ground. Rupa is also a miracle, but you only appreciate rupa as a miracle because consciousness, vijnana, is a miracle. So you remember to come back to awareness again and again and again. It's a process that you keep on smoothly repeating over and over and over. And when you do that, something will develop. Maybe you will be lucky enough in a moment of pain in your body or a moment of painful emotion to actually see the chains that bind you to the painful sensation or emotion. The chains that are causing your addiction. And you can see how you're not even knowing what you're doing. You're tightening those chains and making yourself more miserable. And you're insisting on the misery. This is me. If you see that once, how that's happening, you will never forget it. And you will never allow yourself to be bound in that way again. So the effort that you make in session is really important. It's important for your life, and therefore it's important for everyone in your life and for all of us too. We're doing this together. Each one's effort is helping every other one's effort. So do your best, not only for yourself, but for all of us. And recognize that the work that you need to do in Sesshin, you won't be doing by yourself. You will be helped by everyone else. We all need you to practice completely. I need you to practice completely. I need to practice like this for myself, so I'll be able to better face the many challenges of my life. And the same is true for you too. We all need to practice like this. It's really important for us to become as free as possible from our obsessions so that we can be some good to somebody else. Without freeing ourselves from ourselves, how are we going to do any good for the people we love and the people who need us? One of my favorite Buddhist texts that I've gone back to over and over again over the years is Shantideva's famous text, Bodhisattva Charyavatara, Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Shantideva was an 8th century Indian Buddhist monk who studied at the great Nalanda University, which probably was the greatest Buddhist university ever, and conceivably the greatest university ever known in the world. It was full of monastics and religious people, not only Buddhists but also non-Buddhists, and also people who were not religious. Kings and princes sent their children there, and wealthy merchants and so on. It was, though, a religiously based education, because all education in the 8th century anywhere in the world was religiously based. It wouldn't make any sense in the 8th century to have any other kind of education that didn't start with first principles, religion. So Shantideva was a student there, and he was a brilliant person, but the story goes, he did not appear at all to his fellow students to be brilliant. They thought that he was the biggest slacker in the entire Nalanda University. And they would make fun of him, and they said, Shantideva, you are the master, the absolute master of 3 practices, because these 3 practices are the only things that we ever see you doing. Eating, sleeping, and shitting. So he was known as the master of 3 practices. And probably he stayed up all night, you know, studying and meditating, and they never saw that. They only saw him sleeping during the day and eating and going to the toilet. So they decided that they would play a cruel joke on him. They sort of elected him to deliver this very important lecture And they figured, this is going to be really rich. You know, we'll put him up on the lecture seat. We'll make a big fuss over him. And then he'll open up his mouth and nothing will come out. And boy, is that going to be hilarious. So to make this an even better joke, they built him a big throne, you know, that he had to climb up on. It's like a big challenge to climb up on this throne to deliver this lecture. And they were all sitting there ready to burst out laughing. But to their surprise, Shanti Deva somehow almost magically popped up on top of this very high throne and began spontaneously to deliver, as his lecture, the perfect rhymed Sanskrit verses that form the text of the Bodhisattva Charya Vitara. Everybody was totally astonished by this. And he did this in a voice so loud and so clear that it could be heard all over the vast precincts of Nalanda University. And if this weren't astonishing enough, by the time Shantideva got to the 8th chapter of Bodhisattva Charya Vatara, he began to levitate and he began to rise up into the sky. And by the time that he was delivering the words of the 9th chapter of the text, he was completely out of sight, somewhere in the clouds, even though his voice was just as loud as before and could be heard perfectly enunciated everywhere. So, either Shanti Deva was not your ordinary type of person, or this is not a true story. One or the other. So, as the title suggests, this is a text about the Bodhisattva path. And as we know, the Bodhisattva path is basically defined by the practice of the 6 paramitas: giving, morality, patience, energy, meditation, and wisdom. Prajna, wisdom. The wisdom that is talked about every day in the Heart Sutra. Although this morning it was in Sino-Japanese, so probably most of us didn't understand. So you might expect that there would be 6 chapters to the Bodhisattva Charya Vatara, one for each of the 6 paramitas, as often is the case in descriptions of the Bodhisattva path. But it's not organized like that. There are chapters on Kshanti Paramita, patience, Virya Paramita, energy, Dhyana Paramita, meditation, and Prajna Paramita, the famous 9th chapter. But that begins at chapter 6, 7, 8, 9. The first 5 chapters are organized under a different principle, which they think, scholars think now, is some sort of a devotional scheme. So the text begins with praising bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is the radically altruistic spirit of awakening, the wish to awaken not for oneself, but for others. And this bodhicitta marks the beginning. It dawns on the bodhisattva right at the beginning of the path. And it's the energy of the bodhicitta that propels the bodhisattva forth into many lifetimes of practice. So the text begins with a long poetic praise of bodhicitta. Nothing, Shanti Deva says, could ever be better than, more powerful than, more beautiful than the passion to awaken with and for everyone and to love everyone. This is the greatest possible thing that there could ever be. That's the first chapter. And the second chapter is called Confession of Faults, F-A-U-L-T-S, faults, faults. Because in order to awaken to bodhicitta, the first thing you have to do is confront the powerful tendency within oneself to be small-minded, to want to hurt others in order to protect yourself. You have to kind of look inside and see that you have that and really deal with it. So you have to acknowledge it, be honest about it. See it, acknowledge it, confess it, and work to overcome it. And we did that this morning in the service, right? And we will every day. All my ancient twisted karma is a kind of acknowledgement of our smallness and our need to overcome it. Next, Shantideva speaks of the importance of guarding awareness so that the defilements won't sneak in and screw us up. So it's interesting, you know, the juxtaposition of these chapters. It goes from an inspiring, idealistic hope for a loving heart, extravagantly and poetically described, to a rather depressing sense of how far from such a thing, in fact, we are, and how far we still have to go. And this seems pretty true. Religious practice, I think, is inherently idealistic because we're imagining human perfection and we're committing ourselves to going in the direction of human perfection. In other words, we're not saying we would like a little improvement. We're saying, no, we really want to be perfect human beings, as perfect as we could possibly be in this lifetime. So there's a lot of striving and idealism here. Yet at the same time, that idealism will be frustrating and even toxic if we're not absolutely honest about what's really going on here. And if we're really honest, we would say, wow, you know, I'm not too close to that perfection yet. And we might even be more honest and say, not only am I not close to it yet, but honestly, it would be hard to imagine I could ever get even halfway there. Not only that, but maybe it isn't even possible. Maybe it's not a good idea, even. Maybe I shouldn't have started this in the first place. This would make a lot of sense, you know, if we looked at ourselves honestly and looked at what we were trying to do in practice honestly, we might really think that way. But bodhisattvas don't think that way. Humble as they are, and bodhisattvas are really humble, and very aware of their many, many shortcomings. Nevertheless, they go on and on and on, lifetime after lifetime, in the direction of the absolutely and perfectly good. And the lifetime after lifetime part is really crucial. Who knows how many lifetimes we live, or whether all this stuff about rebirth makes any sense at all. But whether it's true or not, or exactly how it's true or not true, actually makes no difference at all. The point is, bodhisattvas practice in a very large scope and a very large time frame. They know where they're going. They have a clear direction. There's no doubt about the direction. And they're committed to going in that direction. And they do go in that direction. And they keep on going in that direction, setbacks and all, on and on. They do not need to be in a rush, because they know they have lots and lots and lots of time. Almost an infinite amount of time. So there's no hurry. It doesn't matter how far away they are from where they're going, because they have all this time. If they're 30 years old, they have a lot of time. If they're 90 years old, they have a lot of time. They're not worried about time. As long as you're going. And going is an attitude, it's a spirit, it's a commitment, more than it is an activity. As long as you're going, there's an infinite amount of time. Plenty of time. Time stretching forth endlessly. That's the bodhisattva spirit. So when you get discouraged, as we sometimes do get discouraged, we will practice awareness. We will know discouragement as discouragement. We'll breathe into it. We'll feel it throughout the body. And we'll know what it is. And we'll trust that we will receive what we need in time to pick ourselves up and continue to go forward. And this is where Sesshin is a really big help. Because you won't be able to turn on the TV and binge watch a whole bunch of episodes of something. You won't be able to do that. You won't be able to go, you know, to the corner bar and have a beer and hang out with your friends. You won't be able to do that. So it helps. When you get discouraged, the bell will ring and the next thing will happen. And there you'll be, doing that thing with everybody else. And they'll all pick you up. So it's good to work with discouragement in Sesshin. It's much easier. So where does the essential motivation to practice actually come from? At least for people like us who find ourselves here in Sesshin. In other words, people like us who seem, for some reason or another, to be willing to go to extremes in our spiritual practice. Why would we do that? Well, think of the Buddha. The Buddha went to extremes too, didn't he? Why did he do that? Because of suffering. He was shocked to realize that suffering is absolutely inescapable. Now, I always like to point out that there's an underappreciated element of this aspect of the Buddha's story. It wasn't just suffering that he noticed. It was the suffering of others, right? Because the Buddha wasn't suffering. He was young and strong, and he was doing absolutely fine. Plus, he was a man. And in those days, a man was very privileged, even today, but especially then. Plus, he was a relatively high-born person. He did not have problems. He did not have suffering much, really, at all. But he looked and saw the suffering of others, and he realized that the suffering of others wasn't just the suffering of others. He took it personally. He saw the suffering of others and he realized that it was his suffering too. The suffering he saw in people on the street was his suffering. And it was overwhelming. And it was absolutely insupportable. And he knew that something had to be done. He couldn't just accept it. So I'm assuming that we're all like this too. Somehow, some way, whether we understand it in ourselves or not, we too must know that suffering is immense and that the suffering of others around us is personal to us too. It's our suffering and we can't stand it. And we have to do something fundamental about it. Not just make it a little better, a little easier. We have to get to the root of it, to the end of it, as the Buddha taught. In the Bodhisattva path, the end of suffering is brought about by bodhicitta, the radically altruistic spirit of awakening. We take on this attitude, we commit ourselves to it, and we live it. Then, even though all kinds of challenges arise and all kinds of bad things happen, we're not surprised, of course, those things will happen. But we're okay. And we go on with inspiration, with energy, and good spirit. And what stands in the way of our fully taking on the spirit of bodhicitta is exactly the kleshas, the defilements, all of our raga, dvesha, and moha, our attachment, aversion, and confusion about our preferences and our views. This is what stops us. This is what chains us to ourselves. This is what makes us suffer. We're constantly seeing the world through our own viewpoint and making the world painful. In a world of multiple viewpoints, did you ever think of this? Why do we always favor our own viewpoint? You know, why would we? Not some of the time. Not even like 50% of the time. Like 100% of the time. Why? In Zen, they call this looking at the sky through a narrow pipe. You know, a little PVC pipe, you know. You don't see much. The kleshas arise in our bodies and they seem so convincing. In his chapter called, the version I'm reading of Shantideva, the translation of this chapter is called Vigilance Regarding the Awakening Mind, regarding bodhicitta. In this chapter, Shantideva talks passionately about the need to overcome the kleshas. He speaks of it in like battleground terms, like you go to battle with the kleshas. Or you murder them, you grind them into dust, you beat them up. So this is a very extravagant text. The whole Shantideva's text is very, you know, it's like an epic Buddhist poem. It's very wild and extravagant. He really does sometimes sound like he's speaking from high up in the sky somewhere. Anyway, I thought I'd read you some of these verses to get you fired up for the session. And I'll where it's not so clear, I'll kind of paraphrase in my own words to make it clearer, I hope anyway. So he's talking about doing battle with enemies. He says, enemies such as greed and hate don't have hands and feet and other limbs. So they how strong can they be, you know, if they don't even have arms or legs? Plus, they're not that smart. So how could I let them beat me up? How could I let them get the best of me, you know? They're in my own mind. And yet, in my own mind, without any arms or too much intelligence, they seem to strike me down. And nothing happens to them. You know, when the anger makes me crazy, the anger is fine. I'm the one who's a mess. So why am I not like rageful about this? I should be angry at my anger. I should be angry at my greed. What's wrong with me? This is an ill-placed practice of forbearance. If every god and human being were my enemy, everybody, if every human being and every god in all the heavens were my enemy, even that would be not be enough power to send me down to Avicii hell, which is the worst Buddhist hell. There's a lot of different Buddhist hells. They're very colorful. The Christian hells are impressive, but I think the Buddhist hells are possibly even more impressive. And the Avicii hell is the worst of the worst. So in other words, all the gods and people in the world could not be strong enough to send me down there. Where, once you're down there, not even any ash is left over. And yet, in that flash of a finger snap, the defilements can send me right down there. Even all the people in the world couldn't do it, but in 1 second, my anger can send me there. For the long life of all other foes together is not of such length as that of my enemies, the defilements, which is interminably long, without beginning or end. They never die, so respect them. Everyone becomes well-disposed when they are treated with kindness, but when these defilements are honored, they cause suffering all the more. When you coddle the defilements and you take them seriously, they get worse and worse. With all this in mind, while such long-standing enemies, the sole cause of the flowing flood of misfortune, dwell fearlessly within my heart, how can I ever take pleasure in life and just ignore them? There they are, right inside me. What's wrong with me? If these jailers of the prison of existence, who are also the executioners of all the condemned in hell and other places like that, remain in the house of my mind, the cage of greed, how can I be happy? For this reason, I shall not cast off the burden here, meaning die, until these enemies are struck down before my eyes. Once their anger has been aroused, people who are inflated with pride do not sleep until their enemy has been slain, even if he caused only a slight offense. So people get mad when people are, you know, you offend somebody, they get really mad, even if it's just a slight offense. In the vanguard of the battle, violently passionate to kill bringers of darkness destined to, by nature to suffer death. So they go to battle, fighting against people who have offended them. This is like regular people will go to battle, fight against people who have defended them, and they'll suffer all kinds of horrible things in the fight, even though the people they're doing battle with are going to die anyway. When you think about it, like, there shouldn't be any wars. All the enemies are going to die anyway. Why go to all the trouble? You think about it, right? Let's go to war. Wait. All these people we want to kill, they're going to die anyway. Let's save ourselves the money and just wait them out. They're going to die. Right? Doesn't that make sense? Why don't we do that? I'm going to suggest this to the government. The American government needs a big suggestion like this. Did you ever think you can win every war and it won't cost you a nickel? Just wait long enough. So people, but they don't do that. They fight, even though they could wait. They don't wait. They're so angry because they've been offended, they fight with them, right? Anyway. So what then, compared to that, when I am striving to kill my natural enemies, who are the eternal causes of every pain? In other words, the defilements live on and on and on. If people are willing to go to that much trouble to kill people who are going to die anyway, I should be willing to go to even more trouble, right? To kill the defilements who will live forever if I don't do something about it. Today, even if I suffer 100 afflictions, what reason do I have to feel the misery of despair? I should never give up. This is a really good battle. Without cause, they display the wounds from the enemy on their limbs as if they were decorations. Like, well, soldiers are always pulling up their shirt and saying, see, this is where I got hit here and over here. And they're proud of their wounds. Why then, when I am striving to fulfill the great cause, do I let my sufferings oppress me? Why should I be scared of the hard work and the suffering in this battle? Their minds set only on their own livelihood. Fishermen, chandalas, plowmen, and the like withstand such distress as extreme heat and cold. So workers work really hard, and it's hard on the body. They're out working in the cold, and you know they're doing sometimes very difficult, especially in these days, in 8th century India, people were doing really brutal things. And he says if they're willing to do that just for their livelihood, why have I no endurance, though it is for the advantage and well-being of the universe? People are staying up all night just for a buck. Why am I afraid to stay up all night to benefit the entire universe? I have promised to liberate the universe from the defilements to the limit of space in the 10 directions. But even I'm not free from my defilements. So we always say, you know, like right after the Dharma talk is over, we're going to say, beings are numberless. I vow to save them all. Defilements are limitless. I vow to end them all. Have you ever attended a lecture and said this before? It's too late for you now. You said it already. You promised. That's what he's saying. He's saying, oh my God, I just promised to save all sentient beings and I'm a mess myself. And then he says, I must have been drunk when I said that. I must have been, what was I doing saying sentient beings are numberless? I vow to save them. I must have been crazy, but it's too late now. I said it. I can never turn back from this battle now. Sorry, folks. Somewhere in here, he says, maybe you're better off never having started. But once you start, you cannot turn back. It's a famous line in here. So he goes on, I shall be tenacious in this and wage war, sworn to enmity, except against the kind of defilement that comes from murdering the defilements. So I'll fight every kind of passion except the kind of passion that wants to fight passions. Every other kind of passion I'll fight with. And then he says, and I don't care if my guts ooze out. Let my head fall off. But never, ever will I bow down before this rotten, creepy enemy, the defilements. Even if banished, an enemy may acquire retinue and support in another country and return from there with gathered strength. So that's true. You could win the war. It happens, right? Like this exactly happened in Iraq. We won the war and everything's fine now. And then 5 minutes later, the people you thought you defeated, they go somewhere else and they bind up their wounds and they get new recruits and they come back 10 times stronger. This happens. That's why anybody who fights a war is really a ridiculous person. Because A, they would die anyway. And B, when you try to beat them up, they just come back stronger anyway. So it's stupid. That's what he's saying. But there is no resort for this enemy, the defilements. In other words, when I defeat the defilements, that won't happen. They do not come back with a new retinue. They're done. Based in my mind, where might the defilements go when I cast them out? Where might they stay and work toward my destruction? I mean, if you overcome your anger's not going to like go to Iraq and like get new. Anger's going to be gone. I make no effort simply because my mind is dull. In other words, there's no reason for me not to do this. The defilements are weaklings to be subdued by wisdom's glare. And now, this is the ultimate point. The truth is, these nasty defilements are actually very weak. Once you look at them and see them with the eye of wisdom, they prove to be very weak. The defilements do not dwell in objects, nor in the collection of the senses, nor in the space in between. That's it. That's true, right? Where is your anger? It's like, it's not in the person you're angry at. It's not in your eyes or your ears or your nose. And it's not anywhere in between. Where is the anger? There's nowhere for the anger to dwell. And yet, they, all the defilements, churn up the entire universe. And it's all just an illusion. It's all an illusion. So, heart, free yourself from fear and devote yourself to striving for wisdom. Why, quite needlessly, would you want to go on tormenting yourself? Make a firm resolve in this way and strive to follow the training as it has been taught. How can someone who could be cured by medicine get well if she does not follow the doctor's orders? And that's the end of the chapter. So that's the spirit for Sesshin. Don't you think? With a firm resolve and a fierce determination to follow doctor's orders and just do the practice. So Sesshin is Sesshin. It's not the same as ordinary life. In Sesshin, we don't have dialogue and discourse and sharing. We don't talk things over. We don't deliberate. We don't decide what to do. We eliminate all of those things so that we can do what Shantideva is encouraging us to do. So you should just do the practice as it ought to be done, whether you think you agree with it or not, whether you think it's a good idea or not. When the Sesshin is over and you come to the conclusion that it was not a very good idea for you to have come to Sesshin, then you don't have to repeat the failed experiment again. But for now, there is no choice but to give your whole heart to this experience and see what happens. But what if you can't do that? What if you have various misgivings and complaints, doubts, annoyances, rages, and so on? If that happens, this would be really excellent, right? Because there they would be, right? There they would be, those creepy, sneaky, tricky defilements. And you would know exactly what to do. How do you deal with these nasty, creepy kleshas? You try your best to avoid blaming and thinking and going on and on, complaining in your mind. Looking externally for the cause of your upset. But the cause of your upset is not in the arrangements. It's not in all those annoying other people. It's not in the schedule. It's not in the complicated Oryoki instructions. That is not where the problem is. The problem is in your own heart. The problem is that you have somehow allowed the kleshas to have their way with you. And all that complaining and externalizing is a sneaky, clever diversion. They are nothing if not clever, these kleshas. That's how they trick us into believing in them, into making them stronger than they actually are. They appeal to our intelligence. They appeal to our sense of right and wrong. They appeal to our discriminatory capacities. As Shanti Davis says, actually they're not very strong, they're pretty weak. How do they look like they're strong? They thrive on using your mind to make them look stronger. Just like a virus that clamps onto other cells and uses the other cells to get its nutrients and its life. So all you have to do is stop feeding them. Stop the spinning, speculated mind driven by passion. And look the kleshas in the face with the eye of wisdom. Hello, annoyance. This is what you look like. Hello, anger. This is how you feel. Hello, fear. There you are again. You can say those things to yourself thousands of times a day if you have to. Say them silently and take a breath and return to your body. You can pray to Buddha or God or whoever you want to help you, because we all need help in this. Please help me overcome this terrible attachment to my fear, to my anger, to my suffering. Please help me to be present with love and trust in my own body, in my own heart, in my own world that has always loved and supported me even when I didn't see it. So, we know what we have to do. And I think we're off to a really good start. So, let's continue. Just pay attention. Keep your eyes open. Make your best effort, and everything will be just fine. Thank you very much for listening. Be our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them.